This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
She just doesn't buy their mumbo jumbo. So I find all of that, as I'm sure all of you do, indeed refreshing and rare in a politician. So it is truly a pleasure. Keep up the good fight. Thank you for being here, and we can't wait to hear what you have to say about your book. Please join me in welcoming Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the nice introduction, Lisa, Esther. It's wonderful to be here at 6th and I. You can always tell a teacher I will be calling on people in the back row. Pay attention. There may be a quiz at any point during this reading. But I love being back. God, I got to say this with a live audience. I miss it. You know, Senate is fine, but not like this. So it's nice to have human beings on the other side. Okay, who are doing this. So I... So, okay, I got to behave myself here. Well, not too much, but a little bit. Okay, so I thought what I'd do tonight is I would tell a little story about the book, kind of read from the book, tell you a little bit about it, and then save as much time as we can just for questions and answers so I can talk about whatever you all want to talk about. I start this book with my own story. I was the late-in-life baby. My mother always called me a surprise. I was about 30 before I figured out what that meant. I have three much older brothers. By the time this story starts in the early 1960s, all three of my brothers are off in the military. My daddy was selling carpeting. I was about 12 years old when he had a heart attack. And... you know, like a lot of families, a pretty tough time for us. There was a long period when he wasn't working. The bills piled up. We lost the family station wagon. And we had our toes right on the edge of about to lose our house. My mother was a stay-at-home mom who was 50 years old the day she pulled her best dress out of the closet, put it on, and put on her high heels and her lipstick and walked over to the Sears to apply for a minimum wage job. That minimum wage job was enough to save our home and our family, because in the 1960s, a minimum wage job was enough to keep a family out of poverty, and I will never forget that. My daddy ended up as a maintenance man. My mom kept working the minimum wage job. We saved our home, but there was no money for college. So I was one of those. I married at 19. I had babies early. I graduated from a commuter college that cost $50 a semester because I grew up in an America that was investing in its kids, that was investing in education. And when Amelia was a toddler, I had the idea of heading off to law school. I went to a public law school, and starting when she was two, and every morning we would get up and we would put our backpacks on. We were buds, Amelia and I, and we would head out to conquer the world. And the book has lots of stories about this time. You know, this is the time when I would pick her up every day from daycare, and we would tell the funny stories from our lives. She would tell the part about the little boy who smeared chocolate pudding in his hair, and I would tell about the professor who called on the coat in the back of the room. And so we were buds. So that's where I want to pick the story up. So one morning when Amelia was little, she was sitting in a booster chair at the kitchen table eating cereal. I popped a few pieces of bread into our toaster oven, got busy doing six other things, and quickly forgot about the toast. When I saw smoke pouring out of the toaster oven, I grabbed the handle, pulled out the tray, exposing four slices of bread that were on fire, as in flaming up. Always a quick thinker, I screamed. And I threw the tray at the kitchen sink. Three pieces of toast hit the target. The fourth went high, setting the cute little yellow curtains on fire. I screamed again. Then grabbed Amelia's cereal bowl and threw it at the burning curtains. The milk doused most of the fire, and I calmed down enough to realize that throwing things was probably not my most effective strategy. So then I noticed that the toaster itself was shooting sparks and seemed to be on fire. How long had that thing been on? So I got a glass, filled it with water. And calmed down just enough to pour the water on what remained of the flaming curtains. I then grabbed a towel and beat on the toaster until everything seemed quiet. It finally cooled down and I could unplug it. Now, that may have been the year that I started so many kitchen fires that Daddy gave me a fire extinguisher for Christmas. Back then, our toaster oven had an on-off switch, and that was on. On was on, which meant that it was possible to leave toast under the little broiler all day and all night until the food burned, the wiring melted, and the whole thing burst into flames. At some point, and I have no idea exactly when, someone had the idea of adding a timer and an automatic shutoff. This simple change made it a whole lot harder for distracted mothers or anyone else to leave the broiler running and set the kitchen on fire. 30 years later, while working on an article about how the government could protect consumers from predatory financial companies, you like this segue? I thought about those old toaster ovens. By then, it was all but impossible to buy a toaster that had a 1 in 5 chance of bursting into flames and burning down your house. But by the 2000s, it was possible to refinance a home with a mortgage that had a 1 in 5 chance of costing a family their home and putting them out on the street. In fact, it wasn't just possible. Those mortgages were bursting into flames all over the country. So why the difference? The United States government was the difference. By 2007, the year I was writing my article, a government agency actually monitored toasters for basic safety. And if anyone tried to sell a toaster that had a tendency to burst into flames, the agency would put a stop to it. In fact, government agencies ensured the basic safety of pretty much every product offered for sale. The agencies worked to keep us safe. No lead paint in children's toys, no medicines laced with rat poison, no cars without functioning brakes, and no exploding toasters. But in 2007, there was no government agency that would stop the sale of exploding mortgages. So I picked the story up, and it goes through a lot of other pieces. But basically, throughout this book, I tell the story of growing up, being a young mother, starting a career. But the basic thread of my story is the thread of America's story. I'm the daughter of a maintenance man who made it to the United States Senate. I worked hard, but I made it because America invested in kids like me. Coming out of the Great Depression, America made two fundamental decisions that changed the course of history. First, it decided to put in tough rules to help level the playing field. It was all about having a cop on the beat. No one should steal your purse on Main Street or your pension on Wall Street. Other basic safety rules, safe drinking water, safe medicine, and eventually safe toasters. Markets would work better if we had basic safety regulations in them. Second, America built a future for its kids. It invested in education so that kids like me would be able to get better jobs, produce more, and make more money, make more of themselves and their families. Invested in roads and bridges so that anybody could start a small business and the basic pieces would already be in place for how you could get your goods to market, how you could get electricity. All the pieces were there. And the other investment. America invested in a huge pipeline of ideas. It invested in medical research, in scientific research, in engineering research, because we fundamentally believed that if we made those investments, our kids could build a future that their parents could barely dream of. We made those investments, and here's the key. It worked. For half a century, as our families got richer, our country got richer, and as our country got richer, our families got richer. That was what it meant to be an America that was building for the future. And then, about 30 years ago, Republicans started pushing for a different approach. First move, take some of those cops off the beat. Leave the cops on Main Street, but not on Wall Street. Let the big banks load up on risks. Let them paint a bullseye on the backsides of American families. Make the word deregulation the mantra of the day. And the second idea, cut taxes for those at the top. Open up huge tax loopholes for big corporations. And how would we pay for those tax cuts? Well, by cutting investments. Investments in what? Investments in education, investments in infrastructure, investments in basic research. The result? Well, banks and other corporations made huge profits. Billionaires kept more of their money. In other words, the rich got richer and the powerful got more powerful. Meanwhile, the middle class began to crumble. The economy crashed, and our kids, maybe the first kids in American history, to do worse than their parents. By 2009, I was in Washington with two immediate goals: fighting the big banks over the TARP bailout and fighting hard to try to get a new consumer agency passed into law. Still thinking about that toaster, and determined to stop the big banks that cheated families by putting tricks and traps in credit cards and mortgages. I wanted a level playing field. I wanted a new consumer agency that would be part of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms. Now, you'll be surprised by this next part, but the big banks hated the idea. No, I don't mean they just didn't like it. I mean they hated the idea. By 2009, they were spending more than $1 million a day to block financial reform here in Washington. More than $1 million a day lobbying Congress to say no, no, no to financial reform. And number one on their list, go back and look at their quotes at the time, was to kill the consumer agency. That was the deal. So I'm going to pick the story up again at this moment. We had a Democratic majority in the House for 2009, and the House got the financial reforms through, and it had a consumer agency in it. Good, strong consumer agency. But now it was over in the Senate, and it was in the Banking Committee, and the question was, what would happen next? So that's where I want to pick up in the book again. It was Friday morning, January 15th, 2010, and the calls started coming in early. I was at home, up early to work out on the treadmill in the basement, and I was still huffing and puffing when the phone rang for the first time. Had I seen this morning's Wall Street Journal? The rumors were flying on Capitol Hill. The consumer agency wasn't going to make it. In an effort to move the larger financial reform bill forward, Senator Dodd would trade it off. There might be some face-saving attempt to set up the new Consumer Protection Department somewhere else in government, but there would be no strong independent agency with the authority to get much done. The insiders sent the word out. Too bad, so sorry. It was a good idea, but unless the agency was dropped from the reform bill, the whole package of legislation would fail. Better to toss the consumer agency overboard and get the other reforms through. I listened. So this was it. The consumer agency was dead. All the families who had been cheated by big banks and credit card companies, all the hard work by Barney, the consumer groups, Heather, Dan, the president, all that knocking on doors and all those meetings, and now it was coming to an end. So I asked if there would be a vote, even a losing vote, but the answer was no. The death wouldn't be a public execution. Instead, the Senate Banking Committee would propose a financial reform bill with no consumer agency. No one in the Senate, not a single Democrat or a single Republican, would ever have to vote against the agency. Instead, it would just be suffocated quietly in its crib. No one would ever know exactly who had killed it or why. So I ask my last question. When? How long before the locked-in version of the bill would be introduced in the Senate Banking Committee, with or without the consumer agency? Best estimate, it's a little loud. Best estimate, 3 weeks. The deal wasn't finalized, and there were still a lot of moving pieces that needed to be worked out. So I called Dan. Dan is my former student and was my wingman down here in Washington. And I said to Dan, we've got 3 weeks. The way I saw it, we had nothing to lose. I didn't want a job on Capitol Hill, so what did I care if I ticked off a lot of people in Washington? This was our last chance to get the agency into law. If we lost now, we lost forever. We had very little information about what had led to the latest assault on the agency, but we did know one thing. The Senate did not want a tough vote on this issue. Dan explained to me what that meant. The consumer agency was popular, and to a lot of senators, a vote on the new agency meant having to choose between angering families and angering the banks. And they don't want to anger either one. They just preferred that the consumer agency die a quiet and mysterious death. So I figured, too bad. Too damn bad. If a bunch of senators were going to pick the banks over families, then the American public had a right to know. And if we didn't win, at least we could raise one hell of a stink. And that's where the story goes from there. Now, here's what I see. Washington works for those who can hire armies of lobbyists and lawyers. It just doesn't work so well for families. I saw it with the big banks. They cheated American families, they crashed the economy, they got bailed out, and now the big five financial institutions are 38% bigger than they were during the crash in 2008. They still swagger through Washington. They block reforms and push around agencies. A kid gets caught with a few ounces of pot and goes to jail, but a big bank breaks the law, and no one even gets arrested. The game is rigged, and it isn't right. That's how I see it. Yeah. And let me be clear about this. It isn't just the big banks. Look at the choices the federal government makes right now. Our college kids are getting crushed by student loan debt. We need to rebuild our roads and our bridges and upgrade our power grids. We need more investment in medical research and scientific research. But instead of building a future, This country is bleeding billions of dollars in tax loopholes and subsidies that go to rich and profitable corporations. Many Fortune 500 companies, profitable companies, pay zero in taxes. Billionaires get so many tax loopholes that they pay effective tax rates that are lower than those of their secretaries. But all of them have lobbyists. They have lobbyists and they have Republican friends who make sure that they protect every loophole and every privilege for those who already have money and power. The game is rigged. The game is rigged so that the rich and the powerful get plenty of friends in Washington, but not so much for American families. Now, we can whine about this, we can whimper about this, or we can fight back. Me, I'm fighting back. That's the best I know to do. And for me, that's exactly what this book is about. It is about fighting back. The game is rigged, and the way I see it, it is up to us to fix it. Now, before anyone says to you, but change is hard, be realistic about this, I want to tell you one more little story, and it is that little consumer agency. The one the banks hated, the ones they were spending more than $1 million a day in order to make sure that it didn't become law. Well, we got that little agency passed into law. We got it, and we got it in a good, strong form. And better yet, that little agency has just been around for a couple of years now. It has already returned more than $3 billion to American families who got cheated by big financial institutions. So what I learned from that is that, yeah, it's hard to win. You bet it's hard to win. But we can win. We can win when we fight back. I look at this as this is our moment in history. This may not have been how we planned it or where we thought we would be in 2014, but it's where we are. The game is rigged, the playing field is tilted, and Washington is working really well for those who've already made it. They've got concentrated money, they've got concentrated power. The question is, what have the rest of us got? And the answer is, we got our voices and we got our votes. And if we use them, we can make real change. I wrote this book out of gratitude. Gratitude to my mother and father. They worked hard all their lives and ended up with very little. But they died knowing their children had done better than they did. And to my mom and dad, that was success. I wrote this book out of gratitude to an America that once invested in a future for its kids. And I wrote this book out of determination that we will once again make sure that all our kids get a fighting chance. So that's it. That's it. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And we do have time for some questions, which we've collected ahead of time. The first one is, politics is the art of compromise. What have you or are you willing to compromise on in your job?
Okay, that's a place to start after this. you know, I would be willing to compromise on lots of ways to try to build a future for our kids if we could just head in that direction. Look, I get that there are things we have to come together on. I believe that banking should be boring. And that means I believe that we need to go back to the rule from the 1930s from Glass-Steagall and separate ordinary banking, your checking account and your savings account, from investment banking. Now, you might ask yourself, how is that responsive to the question? And the answer is, my co-sponsor on that piece of legislation is John McCain. We've reached across, and we've got a good, tough 21st century Glass-Steagall bill out there. Angus King, who's an independent, is part of that. Maria Cantwell, senator from Washington. We can reach across and find the pieces, and I'm very willing to do that. But the bottom line is, we got to fight for what we believe in. It's got to be about principles that we fight for. So, there we are.
All right. Second question. Would you support a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision to help get money out of politics?
You know, you just got to understand, I'm a law professor, and for a very long time, the idea of anybody talking about constitutional amendment just, you know, kind of makes your eyelashes start to get frizzy. Because it's a kind of scary place to go. And you say to a lot of people, hey, it's okay to get out there and amend the Constitution. You're never quite sure, you know, where this, you know, how this movie will end. But Citizens United is just killing us. And with the Supreme Court we've got right now, saying that those who've got money can pour more and more money into the electoral process, into everything that happens here in Washington, has a fundamentally corrupting effect on what we're trying to do. It makes it harder and harder to do the people's business. It keeps tilting the playing field. And so, let me put it this way. My first choice, the first thing we should do is what we can do under Citizens United, which is effective and instantaneous disclosure of where the money is coming from, because that the Supreme Court has said we could do. We should do it. But I don't kid myself. That's not going to be enough to go as far as we need to go. And I think that's going to mean constitutional amendment. I think that's just where we're going to end up. Okay.
What does feminism mean to you, and how has it affected your life? P.S. You rock.
Oh, that's feminism. I like that. I like that. You know, I'll tell you a story from the campaign. One of the things I started, we never ran for office, and this will be perfectly clear when you read the book. Oh, man, talk about all the beginner's mistakes at the, you know, every part of this. But one of the things that happened very early on was I noticed there were little girls that came to, you know, they'd be in the on the street corners where we'd be out shaking hands, or where, you know, I would go in a cafe. And I made a point from very early on, when I would see a little girl, is to always get down. Remember, I started out teaching public school to special needs kids. Get down where they are. And I get down and I would say, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm running for the United States Senate, because that's what girls do. I gotta tell you, and then there was always one more part. We do pinky promises that we're going to remember. So there are about 1 million pictures up in Massachusetts of pinky promises with little girls all the way up to some really tall little girls. So,
okay. Changing subjects a bit.
I'll take family economics for $200.
Kind of getting there. That's pretty much where we're going.
Oh, okay.
We need to have everyone save more. How can the average person safely save and invest in a perceived market weighted to the wealthy?
Okay. So, can I give a lecture? But this is what I've worked on forever. I just have to do a little bit. So we do, because this is so important to watch what has happened to the median family in America. Back in the early 1970s, the median family in America had put one person into the workforce and bought a house, did a car, did all those things, and had enough money left over to put about 11% of their take-home pay away in savings. Think about what that meant. Think about what that meant for families. They were already in defined benefit plans, right? Retirement plans, had a lot steadier employment and could put money away month after month after month. You roll that forward to the early 2000s, and what had happened to the median earning family in America? So let's go through it. The median family in America was now putting two people into the workforce. Their total family income had gone up, and this had fooled a lot of people by saying the household income was still rising, because the trick was so had the core expenses for running that family. So housing, health care, sending a kid to college, doing child care had gone up so much faster that after they paid the big fixed expenses, not flat screen TVs and going to the mall and buying clothes. After they paid the big fixed expenses, the two-income family of the early 2000s had less income to spend on everything else, on clothing and food and savings, than the one-income family had had just a generation ago. You can guess what happened. Three things happened. Families actually cut back. I know this always shocks people. Families actually spend less today on those basic things, food, including eating out, clothing, carpeting. You can kind of go through all this. Actually, they spend more on alcohol than they used to, but that's another story that we could, maybe these things are related. But that was one. They cut back on flexible spending. That was the first part. Second part, savings rate dropped to basically zero. And the third part of it, they started going into debt. So what had been a little bit of credit card debt and a mortgage that was manageable for a one-income family a generation ago became mortgages that were unmanageable, credit card debt loaded on that that was unbelievable, car loans on top of that, short-term loans, debt, debt, debt. And that has made it almost impossible for families to go forward. And you can just play out from that one. That's the two-income family, the one that's got two people to put into the workforce. Lord protect the family that's trying to get by with just one earner, the single mom who's trying to do this on her own, the family who's trying to keep somebody at home and somebody in the workforce. All of that was to say what this question presumed, and that is the ground has shifted dramatically under America's middle class. It has shifted powerfully against families. And so people who look to their moms and dads, and moms and dads who say, we were putting away money when we were your age, we were saving, the reality is the whole economic picture has shifted. And so I'm going to put this both ways. There are some things families can do. I actually, when you're talking about I've written 10 books, I wrote some real barn burners, like secured credit, a systems approach. It's true. It's true. The book party for that was not big. But there are a lot of law students who work their way all the way through every story in it. But I wrote The Two-Income Trap. It's been over 10 years ago now. Thank you. Somebody's read it out there. Good. I wrote The Two-Income Trap that basically tells the story. And one of the things that happened after I wrote this book is this is the first time that actually people would ask me to come be on television or to do a talk radio show. And what would happen is I kind of go through this story, and then people, the interviewer would say, good, so what should families be doing about it? And, you know, I'd look at this and just think, oh, God, we're all screwed. You know, So my answer was, I wrote a book called All You're Worth, and I'm not here to try to sell another book. I'm here to make a different point. There are things families can do to cut back, to ratchet back. Debt is very dangerous. And to the extent you can get rid of debt, it is always a good thing. If you have a choice between buying something new and paying down your credit card, pay down your credit card. That is the safest possible thing to do. And it is a form of savings. Paying off your debt is a form of saving. So I talk about different things you can do. But the second part is you can do what you're doing tonight. And that is, what I mean by that is be part of the public conversation that we have got to have about how to make the changes in Washington. That shift between the early 70s and the early 2000s didn't happen by some law of nature, you know, like gravity, you know, where you wake up and say, dang, we still have gravity today. You know, it's it always there. It was because of deliberate policies all the way through. Policies about turning the banks loose on families. Policies about driving up the cost of education. Policies that drove up the cost of housing for families. Every one of these. And so for that, I say you've got to have a little long arc on this. But we've all got to get engaged in this and start fighting back to level the playing field. So it's a two-part answer.
Thank you so much. Two for the price of one. Great. We have time for just a couple more questions, and this one actually you've somewhat answered, so I might modify it. The person who wrote it asked, what was the genesis of your idea for the CFPB? How and why did you believe such a game-changing agency needed to be created, which you've talked about a little bit, but maybe you can forecast how it's going to survive into the future.
So it's a good question. I did talk about this, about kind of the idea behind the consumer agency. But here's the key that I want everybody to understand about this consumer agency and everything else that I talk about in markets. I believe in markets. I believe in capitalism. I just think it is a fabulous, fabulous way to build wealth, to move goods and services, but it only works when you've got level playing fields. It does not work when one side, let's take the case of a credit card, hires all the lawyers, is the repeat player, and puts a bunch of tricks back in the fine print so that you think you're buying something at this price. Not really. You're buying it at this price. You think you've got something that's manageable at this monthly payment, and it turns out that not really, because they have the power to change it. For me, markets only work when people get it. And what we want is we want companies to compete, but we want them to compete on doing things like offering a better product. Right? Or better customer service, or cooler, slicker looking cards. I don't care. Get your dog on your card. You know? I'm cool with all that. That's all fine because people can see it. And as long as they can price it, they can decide what they want. That's how markets should work. They should not be competing by, we figured out another way to trick people. And so 5% are going to pay a little more than they plan. We're just going to skim a little off the top here. We're just going to take a few people who tumble into trouble and really crush them and squeeze them for everything we've got. That's not how markets work. They work when we get the basic rules in place. So what's the consumer agency basically supposed to do? And this is what it's doing. It's the cop on the beat. And it's the cop on the beat who says, in effect, you got to make sure people can kind of get the price. And not get the price if they hire 45 lawyers who will sit and go through the fine print. To buy a toaster, nobody has to hire an engineer to go over the wiring diagram. The same thing should be true for a credit card and for a mortgage. And that's what the consumer agency is there to do. And this is what I love about this agency. It's basically out there thwacking the biggest financial institutions when they trick people. And it's, I love this part, it's not letting them at the end say, gee, I don't know who those people were, or I'm going to send them a coupon for $25 off the next time they take out a credit card with me. They say, no, you had enough information to cheat them. You've got enough information to write a check and send it back to them. And that's what the consumer agency is making them do, and I love it.
One more?
Sure.
One more.
Okay,
here we
last
go.
Last question. Make
last
it good
question,
one.
And,
make
and
it good.
You need to know this one is from Melissa from Massachusetts.
Melissa from Massachusetts.
Wherever you are.
Woo!
Oh, there
Melissa!
She is.
All
okay,
right.
Melissa.
Okay,
and,
Melissa.
And she asks
this
Senator
better
Warren.
Be good, Melissa, because I know where you're sitting. Okay. Okay, we're ready.
What a great coincidence. Senator Warren, if you could give one piece of advice to a young person hoping to break through the political gridlock and actually create meaningful change, what would it be?
You want to come to work? All right, Melissa and I are ready. Okay. It's a great question, Melissa. So, look, in a sense, let's all be clear about this. It's not follow the path I followed to get here. Okay, getting married at 19, having children, divorcing, that's not the way. But it is about following a different part of the path about how I got here. I really have been blessed. I work on things I truly care about, all the way down to my toes. And that means I'm thinking about those things before I wake up in the morning, and I'm still thinking about them when I go to bed at night. And the consequence of that for me, and you'll see this in a lot of places, is that odd doors open that were never planned. But when the door opened and I figured out what you could do, or even a glimpse of what you might be able to do, if you ran full tilt through that door, then that was how I built the pieces as I went along. And each time I would take 1 second to glance back and think, boy, this is improbable but I just keep on running. So all I can say to you is if you really care, find your issue, work like crazy on it, you'll do this. You will, Melissa. Thank you all
so
for being here tonight.
Fighting chance.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now.